Introduction to Lesson Number 6, covering chapters 13 and 14. At the close of chapter 12, the Lord gave the teaching concerning the new relationship which is spiritual. And now the beginning of chapter 13 prepares us for the new scene. The same day went Jesus out of the house and sat by the seaside. First, he separates from the house. Then he separates from the multitude and sits in the ship. From this position of rejection and separation, he speaks in a series of parables. These parables are commonly referred to as the parables of the kingdom, and they demand our closest attention, because they are the unfolding by the King of the mysteries of the kingdom. Some of the strange teaching that has been given concerning these parables makes it very difficult for some people to grasp the real truth. But let each one study these parables carefully and prayerfully. One good Bible scholar said, "From a dispensational viewpoint, there is no chapter in the New Testament more needful to be understood than this." It should be noted that the seven parables divide into two groups, with four in the fifth group and three in the second group. The first group was spoken to the multitude in public, and the second group to the disciples in private. I suggest that each group covers the same period of time, which is the time of the king's rejection, and reaches right on to the end, which is the time of harvest or judgment. The kingdom itself was not a mystery, because it was foretold by the prophets, and John the Baptist had proclaimed that it was at hand, and Christ with his disciples had presented the kingdom in power. But there is a new element introduced in this chapter which was previously unknown. That is the mystery which is here revealed in the parables. The student should note that the kingdom of the heavens includes the whole sphere of profession in which the name of Christ is acknowledged. That circle of profession can include both the genuine and the spurious, and so includes people of diverse persuasion. If the adoption of parabolic teaching at this point should raise a question in the student's mind, then read verses 10 through 17, then verses 34 and 35. In the study of the third group of parables, it will be found that seed has an important place in each parable, and the teaching is progressive. In the first parable, the seed is sown, and it is all good seed. In the second parable, two kinds of seed are sown in the same place, but at different times. In the third parable, the seed produces something that was unexpected. In the fourth parable, the seed is seen in its final stage as fine flour or meal. It should also be noted that in each parable there is a conflict of interest between that which is good and that which is evil. In the first parable, the conflict is one of opposition. In the second parable, it is a conflict by imitation, while in the third parable, it is a conflict by association or infiltration. Then in the fourth parable, it is a conflict by corruption. Again, I suggest that careful study will show that this conflict is progressive in its development. In looking now at some of the details of the first group of parables, it should be noticed that in parable number 1, there is the sower, the seed, and the soil. It is clear from the meaning given by the Lord himself that the sower is the Son of Man, and the seed is the word of the kingdom. While the different places where the seed fell represent different kind of people and their reaction to the word that is spoken, the conflict of evil in this first phase is by opposition. First, the opposition of the devil in snatching away the good seed. Second, the opposition of the flesh, which puts on an appearance of being genuine, but in the time of trouble and testing shows that there was no depth or root. That is, there was no reality but just outward profession, and so it shriveled up. Then the opposition of the world with its cares and deceitful riches, choking the good seed. However, in spite of the combined opposition of the world, the flesh, and the devil, some of the good seed fell into good ground and brought forth fruit after its own kind, but in varying degrees. Then follows the second parable, and it appears we are now concentrating on the good ground with its good fruit. The good seed, or the word of the kingdom, has produced the sons of the kingdom. But the enemy comes when men slept, that is, under cover of darkness, and sows another kind of seed in the same field. Here is the conflict of imitation. The field becomes a place of mixed growth, with the wheat and the tares growing together, that is, the genuine and the counterfeit, the sons of the kingdom and the sons of the evil one. Reality and hypocrisy in the same place. This field certainly does not represent the church, because the Master says, let both grow together until the harvest. Whereas in the church the order is, put away from among you that wicked person. But please note, the tare may have the same appearance as the wheat in the early stages of growth, but it will display its true nature at the time of harvest by the fruit it bears. The third parable of the mustard seed becoming a tree and a lodging place for evil agencies would teach that some abnormal thing has taken place. From a careful study of the scriptures, it will be found that a tree is indicative of worldly power, and at this stage, with all its branches, it becomes the nesting place of these evil influences. They come in by subtle infiltration or association to overthrow the original purpose. In the fourth parable, the point of interest is the pure meal and what became of it. A woman introduced that which was foreign to the nature of the meal, and the whole thing became corrupt. The student should take time to study what the Bible has to say about leaven, and it will be found upon examination to represent that which is evil and corrupt, both doctrinally and morally. So that in this fourth parable, it is opposition or conflict by corruption internally. Add these four things together, we find that the devil seeks first to destroy. And what he cannot destroy, he attempts to imitate. And when his counterfeit is discovered, then he pretends to join in, and finally to corrupt. We now arrive at the point where the king leaves the multitude and continues to give instructions to his disciples in private. And in so doing, he relates a further three parables. There is the treasure, the pearl, and the dragnet. As we consider these three parables, we must still keep in mind that the Lord is dealing with the subject of the kingdom in the age between his two advents. However, the viewpoint is changed with the second group of parables. The first group present events as they are witnessed externally by men of sight or worldly wisdom. But the second group presents the development of the kingdom from the divine point of view and apprehended by men of faith. The first group appears distressing and would almost suggest that the idea of God's kingdom is a failure as viewed from the human point of view. But the second group is encouraging to the men of faith because they demonstrate that the divine purposes will be brought to finality. In considering the parable of the treasure in the field, there are two figures that we have already met with in previous parables, namely the field and the man. Consistency of interpretation demands that we still consider the field as the world and the man as being the Son of Man, that is, Christ. But two new elements are introduced which call for some examination, namely, the treasure and the purchase. It should be noted that the man came seeking the treasure because he knew it was there. Then he hid the treasure in the field and purchased the field in order to claim the treasure. By comparing such scriptures as Exodus chapter 19 verse 5 with Psalm 135 and verse 4, and Malachi chapter 3 verse 17, we arrive at a sound conclusion that Israel is God's peculiar treasure. But since the treasure is left in the field, surely it presents the earthly aspect of the kingdom. And when that is brought into effect, then Israel will be on display as the peculiar treasure. There is a future for Israel in the kingdom, but in the meantime she is hid in the field, which is the world, until such times as the merchantman obtains and removes the pearl of great price. That brings to the consideration of the next parable. The merchantman buying the pearl. Pearls are not found in fields, but in the sea, and when they are found, they are removed to another environment, and usually placed on display. Someone may ask, what is a pearl? How is it produced? And a good reply would be, the pearl is the answer of an injured life to that which injured it. Christ was injured at Calvary, but the answer of the wounded Christ to those who wounded him is the church for whom he died. Having purchased his bride, he will have her beautified and put on display, and she will occupy the heavenly aspect of the kingdom. The final parable is that of the dragnet, and this is not gospel evangelism as some have suggested. Please note, this parable is associated with the consummation of the age, and this time factor will be considered again in the prophecies of chapter 24. At the consummation of the age, we notice the work of angels. First, there is discrimination between the good and the bad. Then there is separation between the wicked and the righteous. And finally, condemnation when the wicked are cast into the fire of judgment. The closing portion of chapter 13 confirms his rejection by his own. And while they acknowledge his wisdom, they seek to discredit him on other grounds, and they continue in unbelief. Chapter 14 introduces us to the pathway of the king in his rejection, and four things should be considered. First, the persecution by Herod and the passing of John the Baptist. Second, the problem of the multitude and the provision by the Lord. Third, the flight of the disciples and the prayer and presence of the Lord. Fourth, the plea of the people and the power of Christ to heal. It is interesting to note how and when Matthew introduces these events and gives the details. Herod is moved by the fear of a troubled conscience, and imagines that Christ, is John the Baptist risen again from the dead? But even so, why should Herod be stricken with fear? At this point, Matthew introduces the record of how John had been put to death by Herod. King Herod was a coward and was moved by folly and fury. And in the midst of shameless drunkenness and dancing, he had cruelly beheaded God's faithful prophet. Perhaps this could be a picture of the persecution that was about to descend upon the people during the time of Christ's rejection, and then pointing on to the culmination of persecution during the time of tribulation, when the two faithful witnesses shall be put to death. Then there is the problem of the needy multitude. But the Lord has an ample supply for all who will gladly accept his provision, just as he supplied their need in the wilderness, and will supply it again during the tribulation period. The disciples could only give to the multitude what the Master gave to them, and the provision of Christ is the only thing that can meet the deep, hungry need of the multitude. Having supplied the need of the multitude, the Lord now constrains his disciples to enter the ship and set sail for the other side, while he withdraws to the mountaintop to pray. The disciples encounter a stormy night, but the Lord is conscious of their need while he continues in intercession and decides at what time he will come to their deliverance. The moment is critical, and they are almost overcome. It is the last watch of the night, and the Lord appears and joins them in the ship, when they worship him, and then they arrive at the other side. The people are ready to receive him and acknowledge his power, and make their plea for his blessing. It is suggested that these incidents are placed in this order to convince the first readers of this gospel that Jesus was the true Messiah, the Son of David, but also that they give a prophetic picture of events yet future, when Christ shall come to the relief of the distressed nation of Israel, and when they acknowledge him and worship him, then his power will go out in blessing to others.